So if you think back to November of 2020, we are right in the middle of this massive, deadly once in a century pandemic.
Right, the entire globe is basically shut down at that point.
Exactly. But amidst all of that, more Americans actually managed to cast a ballot than at any other time in human history.
Which is pretty incredible when you think about the logistics of it.
It is. I mean, by every traditional metric, that level of civic engagement during a huge crisis that should have been heralded as this massive triumph for democracy,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. It should have been the ultimate proof that the system is resilient.
Yeah. But instead, that very participation and specifically the methods that we use to achieve it instantly triggered this crazy crisis of legitimacy.
A crisis that honestly nearly broke the country.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is the defining paradox of our modern political era. You have this maximum democratic participation colliding directly with, well, basically minimum institutional trust.
Right.
And when those two forces smash into each other, the shockwave just completely rewrites the rules of reality for the whole nation.
Which is exactly why we are pulling this specific historical era apart for you today. So, welcome to the deep dive.
Thanks for having me back.
Always great to have you. So, our mission here for you listening is to unpack this profoundly complex period. We're looking roughly at, 2020 to 2029.
Right, focusing entirely on the mechanics of elections, the fragility of trust, and the survival of the rule of law.
Exactly. We are looking at how a country navigates a scenario where its citizens just, they no longer share a baseline reality.
And to do that properly, we really have to look at the election system not as like some political game, but as a literal mechanical structure.
Okay, I like that. Like a machine.
Yeah, exactly. Think about trust in a democracy like the engine of a car.
Okay.
For decades, you have this expectation of total invisibility. You turn the key, the engine hums to life, and you just drive.
Right, you're not sitting there visualizing the pistons firing or the spark plugs igniting or checking the serpentine belt.
No, you just expect transportation. We like the complex mechanics of the things we rely on to just remain entirely out of sight, just quietly doing their job in the background.
But if you're driving down the highway and suddenly the engine makes this loud metallic grinding noise.
That invisibility is instantly gone.
Exactly. You pull over, you pop the hood, and suddenly you are looking at this mechanical landscape that is honestly kind of terrifying.
Because now you're suspicious of every single belt, every wire, and every bolt.
Yeah. And that psychological shift, going from just ignoring the system to obsessing over every single sound it makes, that is exactly what happened to the American electorate in 2020.
It really was the ultimate mechanical stress
It
test.
was. Now, before we really get into the weeds, I want to make something very clear to you, the listener.
Yeah, this is super important.
We are not here to validate one political team or invalidate another. That's not what this deep dive is about.
Right, we are just looking under the hood together.
Exactly. We're going to act as impartial guides through the source material. We want to explore how two different groups of citizens living in the exact same neighborhoods experienced entirely different realities.
And to do that, we have to start by examining the environment that actually forced this engine past its standard operational limits.
Right, the pandemic.
Yeah, we really cannot overstate how severely the coronavirus disrupted the basic logistical pipeline of the American election system.
Because, I mean, you simply cannot have tens of thousands of people standing shoulder to shoulder in high school gymnasiums or firehouses for hours on end, right? Not when there is a highly contagious airborne virus circulating.
Exactly. The physical act of voting had to change, and it had to change incredibly
It
fast.
shifted practically overnight, didn't it?
It really did. It went from a localized in-person event to this massive decentralized logistical exercise. Millions of voters were suddenly pushed toward mail-in voting.
And this is where we have to stop and look at the actual mechanics of what that means. Because the transition from a voting booth to, your kitchen table, it's profound.
It changes the entire psychological relationship with the ballot. Let's
Yeah.
break that down a bit.
Yeah, let's do it. Because for most of modern history, the ritual of voting was very tactile and communal.
Right. You go to a specific place on a Tuesday.
Yeah, you show your face, maybe you show an ID, you sign a physical book in front of a neighbor who is volunteering as a poll worker.
You go behind a little curtain, you fill out a paper ballot, you physically feed it into a scanner yourself, and you walk out with an I voted sticker.
Exactly. The chain of custody is incredibly short. It's visually obvious.
You are the primary custodian of that ballot until the very literal moment it is cast.
Right. But mail-in voting fundamentally lengthens that chain of custody.
It does.
Yeah.
And more importantly, it makes that chain invisible to the voter.
Invisible how? Walk me through it.
Well, think about the steps. You request a ballot. It travels through the postal system. It sits in your mailbox.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then you fill it out at home. You seal it in a specialized envelope. You sign the outside. And then you just hand it back to a postal worker or drop it in a metal box on a street corner.
And from the voter's perspective, it basically just disappears into the ether.
It really does. Now, obviously, behind the scenes, election administrators have these incredibly complex systems to manage all of this.
Right. It's not actually disappearing.
No, not at all. The barcode on your envelope is scanned. The signature on the outside is digitally captured.
And then they compare that against the signature on your voter registration card, right?
Exactly. If it matches, the envelope is sliced open. The ballot is then separated from the identifying envelope to ensure your privacy. And finally, it goes into a stack to be counted.
But the average person doesn't see any of that. They don't see the barcode scanners or the signature verification software or the bipartisan teams slicing the envelopes open.
No, they just know they put a piece of paper in a box and they just have to trust that it gets counted.
And when something is invisible like that, and the stakes are literally the presidency of the United States, I mean, that unfamiliarity just breeds deep skepticism.
Which brings us right back to that central paradox you opened with. High turnout is usually the gold standard for democratic health.
Right.
But because this historic participation was achieved through these unfamiliar, invisible mechanics, it created these deep vulnerabilities.
Yeah. So when political figures began to point at this new elongated chain of custody and suggest that, you know, the engine was making strange noises.
That skepticism didn't just fade away after election night. It completely exploded.
And I think it exploded partly because of another weird mechanical quirk of how votes are counted in the United States, something that really warped the public's perception of reality on election night itself.
Are you talking about the order in which different types of ballots are processed?
Yes, exactly that. This is such a crucial piece of the puzzle.
It really is. Because in many states, the law strictly prohibits election workers from even opening the envelopes of mail-in ballots until the actual morning of election day.
Wait, hold on. Let me make sure I have this right. So a county might have, say, 500,000 mail-in ballots just sitting in a secure room for 2 weeks.
Literally just sitting there in boxes.
But by law, they cannot even start that incredibly slow process of verifying signatures and slicing envelopes until 7:00 a.m. on election day.
That is correct. They can't touch them.
That is wild.
Meanwhile, people who voted in person on election day are feeding their ballots directly into machines that tally the results instantly.
Right. So when the polls close at 8:00 p.m., the very first numbers reported on television are almost exclusively those in-person votes.
Exactly. And during the pandemic, the data showed a massive behavioral split in how people voted.
Yeah, the sources highlight this really clearly. Voters who preferred the incumbent, Donald Trump, overwhelmingly preferred to vote in person.
While voters who supported the challenger, Joe Biden, overwhelmingly utilized the mail-in voting options.
Which created this predictable but visually jarring phenomenon on our screens.
The Red Mirage, some called it. On election night, the initial tallies showed massive leads for the incumbent. Because, again, the quick-to-count in-person votes were reported first.
But then over the next 48 to 72 hours, as those millions of mail-in ballots were painstakingly opened, verified, and counted, those leads began to shrink.
And eventually, in several key states, they flipped entirely.
Now, to an election administrator, that is just the math of processing two different streams of data at two different speeds.
Right. It's just data processing. It's totally normal for them.
But to a skeptical voter sitting at home watching the television over 3 days, it did not look like data processing.
No, it looked like a lead was being slowly, methodically erased in the middle of the night.
Yeah. The visual of the shrinking lead validated all that skepticism about the invisible chain of custody we talked about.
And when you have millions of citizens who fundamentally believe the mechanics of the system have been compromised, they don't just accept the results and move on.
No, they demand a resolution. They look for an authority to step in and investigate the engine.
And when the political process fails to provide that trust, the system defaults to the judicial process.
Right. The courtroom becomes the ultimate backstop.
Exactly. Following the November vote, the conflict moved instantly from the ballot box to the judge's bench. We are talking about an absolute avalanche of litigation.
It was, what, dozens upon dozens of lawsuits filed in just a matter of weeks?
Yeah, and the scope of these legal challenges was incredibly broad. They weren't just contesting the final tally.
They were attacking the very mechanics we just discussed.
Precisely. Lawsuits challenged the constitutionality of the mail-in voting expansions themselves. They challenged the signature verification processes.
They even challenged the physical access that partisan observers had to the counting rooms.
Right. The litigation touched every single layer of the judicial system, from rural county courts all the way up to the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so let's look at how the courts actually handled this. Because the legal system has a very specific, rigid way of evaluating claims. A courtroom is not a television debate stage.
No, it is not. A courtroom relies on evidence, procedure, and precedent.
And when we look at the historical record of these dozens of cases, a remarkably consistent pattern emerges from the sources.
It does. The vast majority of these lawsuits were dismissed outright.
And they were evaluated by a highly diverse judiciary, too, right? We're talking judges appointed by Democrats, by traditional Republicans, and dozens appointed by Donald Trump himself.
Yes. Across the board, the dismissals were incredibly consistent.
But I want to really dig into why they were dismissed. Because the reason for dismissal completely defined how the public reacted to the rulings.
That's a great point. Because there are different types of dismissals.
Right. You have cases dismissed for lack of evidence, which is straightforward.
Yeah.
A lawyer makes a claim of fraud. The judge says, okay, show me the proof.
And if the lawyer only has rumors or, you know, unverified internet videos, the judge throws it out.
Exactly. But many of these cases were thrown out for what are called procedural reasons. What does that actually mean in this specific context?
Well, procedural dismissals usually revolve around two core legal concepts. Let's look at standing and laches.
Standing and laches. Okay, let's break those down because I think they are vital to understanding the anger that followed.
They absolutely are. So standing basically means you have to prove that you personally were harmed by the action you are suing over.
Okay.
You cannot sue simply because you are upset about a process in general. You must show a specific individualized injury.
It's like a car crash, right? If I see a car crash on the local news, I might be furious at the reckless driver, but I can't sue the driver.
Right, because your car wasn't hit. You don't have standing.
Exactly. So many of these election lawsuits were brought by voters or politicians who simply lacked the legal standing to challenge the administration of an election in a specific county.
Yes. And the second concept is laches, which is a fancy legal term that essentially means unreasonable delay.
Unreasonable delay. How does that apply here?
Well, if a state legislature changes a voting rule in May and you wait until November, specifically after your preferred candidate loses, to complain that the rule change was illegal.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, a judge will invoke laches.
Basically telling the lawyer, you can't wait to see the final score of the game before you decide to challenge the referee's calls from the first quarter.
Exactly. You should have filed this lawsuit in June.
Okay, that makes sense. The courts operate on these strict procedural rules to maintain order and prevent the legal system from being used purely as a tool for, like, retroactive political maneuvering.
Right. But here is where the reality of the country violently splits in two.
Yeah, this is the crux of it. We have to look at how these exact same procedural dismissals were interpreted by two totally different populations.
Let's start with the supporters of the challenger, Joe Biden.
Okay. To them, the fact that judges across the political spectrum were throwing these cases out was the ultimate validation.
It proved the system worked. The judges looked at the claims, applied the law, found no merit, and shut it down.
It confirmed their belief in the independence and the integrity of the judicial branch.
But then you look at the supporters of Donald Trump. To them, those exact same procedural dismissals were viewed as undeniable proof of a massive cover-up.
Because to them, a procedural dismissal feels like a technicality.
It really does.
Imagine you are a voter who genuinely, deeply believes the engine of democracy is on fire. You take it to the mechanic, the judge.
Right.
And instead of looking under the hood, the mechanic taps his clipboard and says, sorry, you don't have standing to ask me to open the hood.
Or, sorry, you should have brought the car in last month. Case dismissed.
Yeah. To a citizen terrified of fraud, procedure does not soothe that psychological grievance.
No, it feels like a deliberate evasion of the truth. They felt the courts were just hiding behind legal jargon to avoid confronting massive corruption.
It completely reminds me of being at a high-stakes championship sports game. The stadium is packed. Half the crowd is absolutely convinced the referee is corrupt.
Yeah, that the game is rigged against their team and that every single whistle is a crime.
Right. While the other half of the stadium thinks the referee is just doing a great job strictly enforcing the rulebook.
And the tragic result of that scenario is that everyone stops watching the players.
Exactly. The referee becomes the main character. And that's exactly what happened to the judicial branch during this era.
Judges are supposed to be the quiet, invisible arbiters of the law.
Yeah, but suddenly their faces are on the front pages of every website. They are receiving death threats. The institution of the court is dragged directly into the partisan mud.
Which highlights a severe danger to the rule of law. Because when half the population believes the courts are complicit in a cover-up, the moral authority of the judicial branch just evaporates.
Yeah. A court order is ultimately just a piece of paper, right? It only has power if society agrees to respect the authority of the person who signed it.
Precisely. So the legal avenues close. The gavels come down. The courtrooms lock their doors.
But the millions of voters who felt disenfranchised don't just disappear. Their frustration doesn't just evaporate because a judge cited laches.
No, of course not. If the traditional legal system refuses to validate their concerns, they look for a system that will.
And they found it right in their pockets.
Yes. They turned to their screens. And this leads us to the primary driver of the fractured reality we saw in the 2020s.
The information ecosystem.
Exactly. To really understand how two rational neighbors can disagree on the fundamental existence of physical facts, we have to look at the mechanics of how information was being curated and consumed.
Yeah, I want you to think about your own daily habits for a second. A few decades ago, everyone generally got their news from a handful of centralized sources.
The evening broadcast networks, the major national papers.
Right. And even if those sources had biases, they provided a baseline consensus of reality.
But by the 2020s, that model was completely dead. Citizens were getting their information from incredibly fragmented sources.
Deeply niche podcasts, alternative video platforms, and specifically, algorithmic social media feeds.
The word algorithmic is the absolute key here. In the past, you chose your news. In this era, the news chose you.
Oof. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Social media platforms are not public utilities designed to inform the populace. They are private enterprises designed to capture and hold human attention.
And what is the most effective mechanism for holding human attention? Emotional resonance.
Specifically, outrage, fear, and validation.
Let's walk through the mechanics of how this actually isolates a person. Suppose a voter is feeling slightly anxious about the election results.
Okay.
They open a video app and watch, say, a 3-minute clip of a political commentator questioning the signature verification process. What happens next?
Well, the algorithm immediately registers that engagement. It notes that this specific user lingered on a video tagged with election skepticism.
And the software doesn't know or care if the video is factually true, right?
Not at all. It only knows that the video successfully kept the user on the platform. So the algorithm reaches into its vast database and queues up 10 more videos with similar but maybe slightly more intense themes.
It's essentially A/B testing human psychology in real time.
Exactly. And within a matter of days, that user is placed into a bespoke, self-reinforcing information loop.
They are surrounded by videos of statistical anomalies, out-of-context clips of poll workers moving boxes, and impassioned speeches about a stolen country.
To that user, the evidence of fraud seems overwhelming because it is literally everywhere they look.
And the concept we really need to introduce here is epistemic closure.
Right. It's a fancy term, but it describes a terrifyingly simple phenomenon.
Yeah, it's what happens when an information system becomes completely sealed off from outside verification. Within this algorithmic bubble, contrary information physically never reaches the user's screen.
And even if contrary information does somehow penetrate the bubble, say, a news article about a judge dismissing a fraud case.
The ecosystem already has a built-in defense mechanism for that.
Exactly. It frames the judge as part of the conspiracy. The ecosystem trains the user to view all outside evidence, not as a correction, but as further proof of how deep the corruption actually goes.
It's a perfect, impenetrable psychological fortress.
It really is.
But meanwhile, let's look at the voter's neighbor. The neighbor who supports the new administration, they are existing in a completely different algorithmic reality.
Their feed is serving them clips of election security experts, fact checkers debunking the viral videos, and legal scholars praising the resilience of the system.
Right. To the second voter, the evidence that the election was perfect is equally overwhelming because it is everywhere they look.
This is why the arguments of the 2020s feel so impossible to resolve. You have two citizens living in the exact same town, looking at their phones, and logically arriving at completely opposite conclusions based on the evidence they're being actively shown.
They aren't acting irrationally. They're acting highly rationally within an irrational, curated environment.
Which shifted the entire nature of political debate in the country. We essentially stopped arguing about policy.
Yeah. The national conversation mutated into a meta-argument about the information itself. The battlegrounds became disinformation, censorship, algorithms, and the role of fact-checkers.
That's a huge point. Let's look at fact-checkers for a second.
Okay.
In one reality, independent fact-checkers are viewed as the essential defenders of objective truth, right?
Yeah.
The referees trying to keep the game fair.
But in the other reality, those exact same fact-checkers are viewed as partisan gatekeepers, using the guise of objective truth to censor dissenting opinions and control the narrative.
Exactly. When you cannot even agree on the authority of the person holding the rulebook, dialogue just ceases. You are left with two warring factions shouting across a digital chasm.
And what makes this psychological chasm so incredibly volatile is that it's mapped onto a physical system that is already practically designed to generate confusion.
Yes, the actual structural blueprint of the American electoral system.
Because to a lot of people outside the U.S., and frankly, a lot of people inside it, the way the country actually runs an election is completely baffling.
It is deeply counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
When you elect a president of the United States, the federal government in Washington, D.C. does not run that election.
Right.
The process is completely decentralized.
Mm.
It is organized, funded, and executed by the 50 individual states.
And frequently delegated even further down to thousands of individual counties and municipalities.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
To visualize just how chaotic this is, imagine the United States election system is a massive nationwide franchise restaurant. Let's call it Democracy Burger.
Okay, Democracy Burger. I like it.
Now, usually if you walk into a franchise in New York, you expect the menu and the rules to be identical to a location in Texas.
Sure.
But with Democracy Burger, every single state has a completely different menu. They have different opening hours, and they have wildly different rules for how you are legally allowed to order your food.
The variance is staggering.
Yeah.
You're talking about different laws governing how and when you can even register to vote.
Different rules for what constitutes acceptable voter identification.
Completely different timelines for requesting, mailing, and processing those absentee ballots we talked about earlier.
Even different thresholds for when a mandatory recount is triggered.
Yes. In one state, you might be able to register online on the very morning of election day, walk in without an ID, sign an affidavit, and vote.
But in a neighboring state, if you didn't register 30 days in advance and you don't possess a state-issued photo ID, you are just turned away at the door.
Now, constitutional scholars point out that this decentralization is intentional. It's rooted in the Elections Clause of the Constitution.
Right. It's not an accident.
No. And the advocates for this system argue that it acts as a massive structural firewall against tyranny.
Because if a corrupt federal executive wanted to rig a national election, they couldn't just hack one central mainframe in Washington.
Exactly. They would have to successfully infiltrate and manipulate 50 different sets of state laws and thousands of county-level election boards.
All operating on different software and different paper systems. It's just too fragmented to control from the top down.
The inefficiency is viewed as a security feature.
However, the critics of this system point out the fatal flaw that was exposed in the 2020s. A decentralized patchwork is a breeding ground for localized incompetence, severe inconsistency, and ultimate distrust.
Think about the voter living in that algorithmic bubble we discussed earlier. When the rules are so complex and varied from state to state, it provides endless ammunition for bad faith actors.
A political commentator can easily point to a procedural difference between two states and falsely frame it as a massive conspiracy.
They can say, look, Pennsylvania allows ballot drop boxes in public parks, but Texas outlawed them. Pennsylvania must be facilitating fraud.
When in reality, it's not a conspiracy at all. It's simply two different state legislatures exercising their constitutional right to write their own laws.
But the complexity makes the truth incredibly difficult to explain, and the conspiracy incredibly easy to sell.
And this leads us to the massive legislative fallout that happened after the 2020 crisis. Once the immediate shock wore off, state legislatures across the country didn't come together to unify the rules.
No, they did the exact opposite. They wildly diverged, creating an even more extreme patchwork.
It was a fascinating dual-track reaction. We saw states drawing completely opposite conclusions from the exact same historical event. Let's look at the mechanics of these new laws.
In several states, legislatures looked at the stress test of 2020 and concluded the system was far too vulnerable and had invited massive potential for fraud.
So they tightened the belt.
They did. They passed sweeping legislation that mandated strict photo ID requirements for mail-in ballots. They drastically reduced the number of physical drop boxes available.
They shortened the window to apply for an absentee ballot, too, right?
Yes. And in some cases, they made it illegal for third parties to collect and return ballots for other voters, a practice commonly known as ballot harvesting.
And the stated goal from the lawmakers drafting these bills was security. They argued these guardrails were essential to restoring the public's shattered faith in the integrity of the vote.
Yes. But simultaneously, legislatures in other states looked at 2020 and concluded that the expansions used during the pandemic were a massive success that brought more people into the democratic process.
So they codified those emergency measures into permanent law. They loosened the belt.
Exactly. They passed laws mailing a live ballot to every single registered voter by default, regardless of whether they requested one.
Wow.
They expanded early voting periods to stretch on for weeks. They implemented automatic voter registration when citizens interact with state agencies like the DMV, and they expanded the use of secure drop boxes.
Which creates a fascinating but honestly agonizing tightrope walk for the concept of democracy itself. It is the eternal tension between accessibility and security.
It really is a tightrope. If a state focuses entirely on security, demanding multiple forms of ID, limiting hours, restricting mail, they inevitably disenfranchise legitimate voters.
Right, particularly lower-income citizens, the elderly, or those who just can't easily take time off work.
But if a state focuses entirely on accessibility, mailing millions of ballots out automatically, removing signature checks, they erode the public's confidence that the system is secure against manipulation.
And in the 2020s, the United States fundamentally lost the ability to agree on where that balance should be struck. The country fractured into two distinct legal environments, operating on two completely distinct sets of facts.
Which brings us to the darkest chapter of this timeline.
Yeah. We have been outlining the ingredients of a massive pressure cooker today.
We really have. You have an electorate living in isolated, algorithmic realities, stripped of a shared factual baseline.
You have deep confusion generated by a patchwork of state laws.
You have the total exhaustion of the legal system, with courts being dismissed as corrupt by half the country.
You take all that heat, you trap it in a constitutional pressure cooker, and eventually the metal bends, the pressure blows.
It erupted on a very specific, unforgettable date, January 6th, 2021. From a historical perspective, this is the singularity of the era, the event that forced the domestic crisis onto the global stage.
Let's walk through the mechanics of that day, because it highlights exactly how a mundane bureaucratic procedure can be transformed into a violent flashpoint.
Right. So on January 6th, the United States Congress meets in a joint session at the Capitol building.
Under the Electoral Count Act of 1887, this is designed to be a deeply ceremonial administrative day.
Completely administrative. The states have already certified their votes. The electors have already cast their ballots. The physical certificates are literally driven to the Capitol in these mahogany boxes.
Right. The role of Congress, and specifically the vice president who presides over the session, is essentially just to open the envelopes and read the math out loud. It is the final formal period on the end of the election sentence.
But because every other avenue of recourse had been exhausted, the state legislatures didn't intervene, the courts dismissed all the lawsuits, this obscure 19th century administrative ceremony became the absolute last choke point.
It became the final stand for the voters who believed the election was stolen.
And as the whole world watched, a massive crowd of protesters gathered outside the Capitol. And the unthinkable happened.
The perimeter was breached, windows were smashed, security forces were overrun.
Thousands of individuals violently forced their way into the halls of the United States Congress, halting the certification process and sending lawmakers fleeing into subterranean bunkers.
The physical reality of the American Democratic engine catching fire on live television.
Yes. But again, acting as impartial historical guides here, we have to examine the dual perspectives on why this happened. How is this event internalized by the two different realities we've been tracking?
Right. For the vast majority of the country, and certainly for the institutional establishment, January 6th was viewed as an attempted subversion of democracy.
It was the terrifying, logical conclusion of unchecked political polarization and algorithmic disinformation.
It was seen as a direct physical assault on the most sacred tradition of the American Republic, the peaceful transfer of power.
It was the ultimate proof that words matter and that convincing people an election is rigged has real-world violent consequences.
Yeah. But we must also look at the perspective of those inside the epistemic closure we described earlier.
This is vital to understand.
Yeah.
To many of the individuals who breached the Capitol and millions who supported them from home, they did not view themselves as insurrectionists trying to destroy democracy.
Because they fundamentally believed the election had already been stolen.
Exactly. They viewed themselves as patriots trying to save democracy.
They believed they were the immune system reacting to a virus. They were acting highly rationally based on the completely fabricated reality their information ecosystem had built for them.
Which is what makes the event so historically tragic. The true danger of a fractured reality isn't just that people disagree, it's that people will take extreme violent action based on a completely distorted set of facts.
And the shockwaves of that violence didn't stop at the borders of Washington, D.C. I want to pivot to the global implications, because this is where the domestic crisis becomes a literal geopolitical earthquake.
Oh, absolutely. The imagery of the U.S. Capitol under siege, lawmakers hiding under desks, tear gas in the rotunda that was broadcast live to every single capital on Earth.
The international fallout was immediate and severe.
It was. For decades, the United States had positioned itself as the global exporter of democratic ideals. It lectured other nations on the rule of law and the sanctity of elections.
And within hours of the Capitol breach, authoritarian regimes, specifically in Beijing and Moscow, weaponized that imagery.
They ran the footage on a loop on state television.
Yeah, they used it as a massive propaganda victory to argue to their own citizens that democratic systems are inherently weak, chaotic, and inevitably lead to mob violence.
They argued that their own dictatorial, centralized models offered stability and safety.
I mean, how does an American diplomat even begin to defend human rights or democratic norms overseas when the authoritarian they're negotiating with can just hold up an iPad showing a guy in face paint sitting in the vice president's chair?
They can't. It severely undermined American soft power for years.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond our adversaries, the panic was honestly even greater among our allies.
Imagine being a diplomat in Paris or Berlin or Ottawa watching this unfold.
The European allies were actively questioning the fundamental stability of the American state.
They were asking themselves, is the anchor of the Western alliance collapsing from the inside?
Exactly. Foreign ministries have to make strategic calculations based on the reliability of their partners.
Right. If the United States is so deeply consumed by domestic instability that it cannot even agree on who won its own elections, how can Europe trust Washington to honor a long-term defense treaty?
How can they rely on American leadership in a global economic crisis? The local crisis of trust mutated into a massive liability for global security.
Which brings us to the absolute foundational question of this entire deep dive. We've traced the timeline from the socially distanced voting lines of the pandemic through the labyrinth of the court system into the algorithmic echo chambers.
Across the chaotic patchwork of state laws and finally to the physical violence at the Capitol.
We have looked at all the broken parts, but what is the overarching lesson?
It leads us to the ultimate, undeniably profound takeaway from this era. We tend to think of democracy as a machine. We think that if we just print the ballots correctly and secure the voting machines and count the math accurately, democracy will function.
But this decade proved that the technical process is secondary.
It's just hardware.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The software of democracy is the citizenry.
Yes. Democracy requires the citizens to actively participate in a shared illusion. It requires them to accept results that disappoint them.
It requires them to view their political opponents not as evil, existential enemies, but simply as fellow citizens with different ideas.
And underneath all of that, it requires a foundation of shared facts.
Think about it like paper money. I love this analogy from the source material because it crystallizes exactly what trust is. If I hold up a $20 bill, physically, what is it?
It's a blend of cotton and linen with some green ink on it.
It has zero intrinsic physical value. You can't eat it to survive. You can't build a shelter out of it.
It is objectively worthless as a physical object.
But it has immense power because of a shared psychological agreement. You, me, the government, and the grocery store clerk all collectively, simultaneously agree to believe that this piece of paper is worth $20.
It is a shared illusion that allows our entire economy to function.
If tomorrow morning half the country woke up and decided they no longer believed the green paper had value, the economy would collapse by noon.
The paper wouldn't have changed. The belief would have changed.
Exactly. And democracy is exactly the same way. The Constitution, the ballots, the Supreme Court rulings, the Electoral Count Act, they are all just ink on paper.
They have no physical power to govern us unless we all collectively agree to respect their authority.
When the shared belief disappears, the paper is just paper.
Which forces us to confront the core question posed by the historians analyzing this era. Can a modern democracy actually function when massive groups of its citizens fundamentally differ on what is real?
Can you have a country without shared facts?
The historical record suggests that it is possible for institutions to survive on sheer inertia. As we saw, the courts did not collapse. The states continued to function.
The certification was completed.
But surviving is not the same as thriving. Attempting to run a democracy without a shared baseline of reality is incredibly unsustainably risky.
Because it turns every minor disagreement into a war. You don't need everyone in a democracy to think the same. We are supposed to disagree. We are supposed to argue passionately about tax rates and foreign policy and healthcare.
But you have to agree on the dimensions of the playing field. To use your sports analogy from earlier, we can argue furiously about whether a penalty kick was justified, but we have to agree that we are actually playing soccer.
Right. If half the field thinks we're playing rugby and they start tackling the referee, the game is over.
That is the perfect encapsulation. When that minimal shared reality vanishes, political division mutates from a debate over policy into a desperate fight for survival.
This era serves as a blaring siren. It's a profound warning, not just for the United States, but for every modern democracy attempting to navigate the algorithmic information age.
If the world's oldest continuous democracy can be brought to the brink by a collapse in shared facts, the mechanics of trust are fragile everywhere.
All right, let's take a deep breath. We have covered an immense, heavy landscape today.
We really have.
We've looked under the hood of a system pushed to its absolute limits, exploring the mechanics of voting, the strict procedures of the judiciary, the psychological traps of our own smartphones, and the geopolitical fallout of domestic division.
And we've boiled it all down to the fragile, essential currency of trust.
It is a sobering exploration, but a strictly necessary one to understand how we arrived at the current moment.
Absolutely.
And our exploration of this historical dossier is far from over. Before we sign off, I want to give you an exciting look at where we are heading next. In our next deep dive, we will be unpacking Chapter 4, which is titled The Change in the Republican Party Model.
That will be a fascinating pivot. We will be analyzing a massive ideological transformation.
Yeah, we'll trace the evolution of the GOP from the era of Ronald Reagan, a party defined by traditional conservatism, free market economics, and muscular global engagement, all the way to the era of Donald Trump.
We're going to look at the mechanics of populism. We'll explore the rise of America First nationalism, the fierce internal battles for control of the party's infrastructure.
And what the historical data suggests about the future of conservative politics. It is a story of political evolution that reshaped the entire globe.
But before we get to that, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, directly inspired by our conversation today.
Okay, let's hear it.
We spent a lot of time discussing the paradox of the modern internet. We have access to all the information in human history, yet we find ourselves starving for truth.
An abundance of data, but a famine of trust.
Precisely. So if the ultimate challenge of this century is protecting our democratic institutions when trust is so scarce, what happens when the very tools we have historically relied upon to establish the truth are broken?
You mean the investigative media, the independent watchdogs, the judicial system, and the voting booth itself?
Yes. What happens when those are the exact mechanisms we've been trained no longer to trust?
How do you establish reality when the arbiters of reality are broken?
Exactly. How do you repair a shattered mirror when the only tools you have to fix it are also made of broken glass?
Wow. That is an incredibly haunting thought to end on. It's the puzzle we all have to figure out how to solve. Thank you so much for joining us under the hood today, for sitting with these heavy concepts, and for taking this complex journey through the mechanics of reality. Remember to stay curious, keep questioning the systems around you, and we will see you next time for another deep dive.